I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with our usual weekly Saturday live stream. And our guest today is David Zutty of the Homeland Institute. And David is here to talk about the Homeland Institute's most recent poll, which deals with immigration and deportation. So David, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here as always. Happy Saturday.
Thank you very much. So I want to just dive into this poll and see what we can use from it. Is there stuff in here that's encouraging for people who would like to see a reversal of the Great Replacement? First of all, you talk about the idea of deportations and the popularity of deportations for illegal immigrants, which is something that's now on the table with the Trump campaign. So can you talk a bit about people's attitudes towards deportation?
Absolutely. So before I begin, and I will revisit this a little bit, there is a huge difference in the public mind between legal and illegal immigrants. And the good news is that in regards to illegal immigrants, they are very much in favor of mass deportations, even several Democrats. So that's very encouraging. This is something across party lines. Now, there were fewer Democrats in favor of mass deportations than the Axios poll, which was conducted. However, I think that is most likely because a lot of Hispanics are actually more likely to be in favor of mass deportations because, well, they know it's coming across the border and they have theirs and they want to protect it. While a lot of white voters, they might have issues with white guilt and all that. That simply doesn't work on Hispanics. They don't care. So that's very good. And I think that's also important because if we explain to white liberals or independents that, look, even a lot of Hispanics want to stop this tidal wave of illegal immigration, that will get them on board. That will give them permission. And yes, it's silly, pathetic, annoying that we have to give them permission. They can't advocate for themselves as every other group does, but I'll take it. We have to work with what we have.
Yeah. So what percentage of the populace is for deporting illegals? And can you break that down in terms of Democrat, Independent, Republican, and also age groups?
Yes. So I can't do age groups. I did that for the first question, which I'll get to in a little bit, but 55.1% of all respondents and 85.6% of Republicans support deporting all or almost all illegal immigrants. So that's very, very high. And the 55%, that was very close to the Axios poll. We were able to replicate that. And also this poll is partially a replication of the Axios poll. A lot of Homeland's projects, we look at mainstream polls and we try to replicate the results, but then we go further, both to check the results that they got and make sure it's true, but also if our results match up, that means we can, the other questions we ask, those answers have a higher degree of confidence. And for the Democrats, it looks like over 20% either strongly supported or slightly supported deporting all undocumented. For independents, that was 50%. And so that's huge. There's a very strong majority that are in favor of deporting all of them. So there's no reason. And this is only, by the way, the Homeland, this poll was only of white registered voters. In the future, I like to poll non-whites too, or at least Hispanics. However, there's been a problem of getting enough of these different races and having their subgroups properly balanced. For example, age, education, ideology, party affiliations, so that they actually do resemble the non-white electorate. And more importantly, the electorate for each of their race. For example, the blacks need to look like blacks. Asians have to look like Asians. I can't swap sub-segments back and forth between them, or I don't think it would be very useful. But no, this is big, and it's even higher amongst Hispanics. Yeah, the mainstream poll actually found that a lot of Hispanics were in favor of that. So that's huge, too. So yeah, there's no reason why Trump should not do mass deportations. The whole country is behind it. And I do want to make a huge point here, and I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir, but legal immigration is much worse than illegal immigration because they can vote and it's easier for them to access social services. I mean, in California, they basically throw everything at all the immigrants regardless, but in most states, it's harder to get stuff like insurance and all that. But this is very dangerous. But the good thing is that everybody is in agreement upon deporting illegals. And hopefully what I hope we can do here is a slippery slope. For example, we didn't wind up with Drag Queen Story Hour overnight. The left had to push for that over about a decade or so. Well, getting mass deportations or adopting policies to repatriate people, that probably won't happen overnight either. But if we start with the mass illegal deportations, that might break the ice. That might get people in the mood. And this is why there's been a lot of pushback about even clamping down on illegal immigration, because the left and the establishment and the rhinos, they know that this is a slippery slope. Once you let people have fun deporting legal immigrants, they might ask for more. They want to go further. They've broken down some of these mental barriers they have about anti-racism, because the whole thing is a very racial question. So I'm very hopeful about that.
So what is the hang up on legal versus illegal? Is it basically just because they want to say, oh no, we're not racists. We're just opposed to people who are breaking the law. Is that basically it?
I have several theories about this, some of which is backed up by data in the poll. I think additional polling might be needed. For example, I wasn't planning on polling on immigration back to back, but with Trump's absolutely disastrous policy of stapling green cards to diplomas, I think it's called for. So I might also explore why people think that legal immigrants are okay. For example, in this poll, I gave the standard party line of, I asked people's opinion on the statement, illegal immigrants are net negative, but legal immigrants are net positive. Because that's the general party line for both, for at least the Republicans, where, you know, they have to replace this legally, as Trump would say, with his silly voice. But I think part of this is the issue that people are trying to avoid being racist. I actually wrote a follow-up article on Countercurrents about this. And I do think a lot of them, they want to try to get their cake of a nice white country, but eat it too without having to be racist, advocate for their interests like everybody else does. And that simply isn't tenable. For us, that's obvious. For them, they're trying to pretend like they can play this game or keep stuff as it always was. And that isn't possible. A lot of this is driven by race. It's not their status as legal or illegal. That's simply a label. It's their race that's a problem. And a bunch of people from third world countries will turn it into America into a third world country too, regardless of whether they are a citizen or not. In fact, it will go quicker if they become citizens because they can vote and they can drain the social services, even though, let's be honest, it's a decaying empire, so who cares? They're just printing money at this point. But regardless, legal immigration is worse. Especially if they start doing chain migration, like they have these large connections, and this makes it easier for them to bring the whole village across, which is very dangerous. And a lot of illegal immigrants, I don't know the exact number, but quite a few of them are itinerant. They go back and forth across the border to do work, el trabajo. They're not trying to settle here permanently. So as much as I don't like them either, I actually prefer this because they aren't camping out for ever and ever and changing the demographics. They go home, at least for half the year. But I do think there's a lot of other issues here. It's a very complex subject. Part of it is that legalism is very much ingrained in the Anglo-Saxon culture. That was in Britain. It got out of hand. It got transferred over to America. There was an issue with English lawyers just going crazy and being verbose. It's a very strange culture. It has to do, I think, with the Faustian world feeling. And America inherited that. And yes, they kind of broke free, but not really. They just went even more legalistic. And this is further compounded by how the Constitution, it appears to have lasted for 250 years. That's not really true, but it appears that way. A lot of other countries, they have, especially France, they have these rapid changes in government. So law for them is more of just like, it really is the booty of the plunderers, or it's simply what our nation is doing at this given moment. For America, it's this holy, sanctimonious thing about my constitution and, oh, the law gets put up on a pedestal, but really the law is simply the booty of the conqueror. And I think Americans really need to start looking at law as simply not the sanctimonious thing. Or you have these sovereign citizen types, they think that because they make this archaic legal argument that they win somehow. And that's not true. They need a hefty dose of Carl Schmitt, Oswald Spengler, and realism. But no, the Americans, they always want to, they're very much law and order people. And that is to their detriment when they're dealing with people who are not law and order, and they see law as simply a weapon to wield against them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that legalism is definitely part of this. But again, people lose touch of the assumptions, the necessary conditions for living in a law-abiding society, which has everything to do with, well, being a white society, having a white tradition, white homogeneity, high trust, and all those traits. And if people don't belong to that particular culture, well, they just look at the legal system as something to hack. And they've very successfully hacked our legal system. Of course, we have a long history of having extremely bad faith, manipulative attitudes towards the law too. But these people come in and they don't see it as sacred in any sense. They just see it as something that they can use to manipulate us. And we have to get over that. We have to stop being chumps. And it's part of a larger worldview, I guess. You can just call it colorblind individualism. We all just follow the same rules. We just act as individuals. We don't need to worry about the greater good or the long term. And if we don't see color, color won't see us. And we just don't understand that that is beneficial only if we can exclude people who free ride on that system. And we have open borders now to the world, and therefore we cannot exclude free riders, people who want to cheat, basically, at the liberal individualist system. And what they do is they demand that we treat them as individuals in every transaction. And then when they have favors to confer, they'll pretend to give us a fair shake, but then everything goes to cousin Abdul, because that's their system. And it works with Indians and Chinese and Arabs and so forth. Basically, all of these recently arrived groups are highly ethnocentric, they're highly clannish, and they cheat. And the long-term result of living in a system where we have to play fair and they get to cheat is white dispossession. And just to get that people through people's thick heads is a huge amount of our work.
Yeah, I want to make a couple comments on that, actually. So there was an article a while back in Current Currents I really liked about game theory, about racial game theory, about, I think it was Thomas Joybin, if I recall correctly. And this is important because with game theory, it's about a simple scenario about between cooperation and competition and a prisoner's dilemma, where if you both agree to cooperate, you have a good outcome. If you both agree to compete, you get a bad outcome. But if one cooperates and one competes, you get a super good outcome and a super bad outcome, depending on whether or not you betray the other or if you're the chump. And this is racial game theory. They all are playing to win. They're all competing against us by cooperating as a group. And then we're trying to cooperate with them by playing this game of being an individual. And that simply leads to being taken advantage of over again and again and again. Another thing, too, about a lot of this comes down to, I think, is the Faustian world feeling kind of going off the rails because it's going through its intellectual phase, it went through its intellectual phase. It's hopefully we'll get out of that soon with the enlightenment of all of this. And the Faustian yearning for the infinite is very close to universalism. And, for example, Germanic Christianity is very universalist in its viewpoint. And the problem with universalism is that it's actually highly particular. This is a particular impulse from a particular people at a particular time. Most other people across time and space are not universalists. They're interested in the here and now and the me. Some are in the other extreme, the whole opposite direction, such as the ancient Greeks and Romans. You could say they got universalist towards the end, but at first they were very focused on the here, the now. You know, the ancient Indo-Aryans had their hearth gods. This is very much a me thing. In fact, they were the opposite of the Abrahamic faith. Their religion was, if not secret, highly personal. It's for the family or tribe only, and other people had to do their own religion. They didn't want to spread their family gods to other families. That was just weird. But everyone else is a lot more particular and focused on themselves and doing things their way, and they don't think universally. They don't think about universal individuality and all this. And so a lot of these, especially Anglo countries, they need to get out of their heads that, in a way, by being universalist, they're ironically trying to be a colonialist and impose this very particular review of universalism on the rest of the world. And it simply isn't going to work. On one hand, that back in the past when there was colonialism, they risked destroying native cultures. Today, they risk destroying themselves.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. Let's look at some of the other results from the poll. I'm trying to figure out ways that white advocates can create a consensus for basically reversing the Great Replacement. And yes, the first thing that we have to do is we have to close the borders. Second thing that we have to do is deport people who come here illegally. But that's never going to be enough. It's not going to be enough because so many of them are here legally, or they came illegally and they've been amnestied in one way or another. And just the differential fertility, I think, is a problem. Whites in America are still not reproducing up to replacement levels. Non-whites coming in, they're having their own fertility problems, but they're still, I think, going to be outbreeding us for some time. We simply can't close the borders and pray. We have to start instituting deportation, repatriation, let's call it repatriation programs for people who are legal or legalized. And obviously there's a lot of hesitancy for that. And I guess the question is, what do we have to work with? You said, okay, let's work with getting the, there's a consensus for deporting the illegals. Maybe if that goes okay, if the dystopian predictions aren't met for that, then we can start making a case. But is there anything in the poll that gives any indications on how we might build a case for phase three, which is repatriation of people who have been settled here for a while and have legal status in America?
Yeah, so one of the things I noticed is that Republicans are, to be blunt, greedy. Money talks. And so they are, for any type of program that seemed to be saving money, such as preventing immigrants from accessing public health insurance like Medi-Cal, they were all in favor of that. However, repatriation schemes that cost money, such as giving immigrants $5,000 and sending them on their way with a plane ticket, that was very low. In fact, there were slightly more Republicans in disagreement with that policy than Democrats. And I think it's obvious why. It's about money. All of a sudden, the Democrats, their hearts are, they're opposed to it because their hearts are bleeding. The Republicans are opposed to it because their wallets are bleeding. And I think what we can do here, this sounds horrible, but this also gives us a vector of attack. We've identified the problem. We can identify the solution. If money is what they care about, we can explain to them that legal immigrants, too, are a net economic negative. For example, if they require education, if they access social services more, I might be starting an intern program for the Holman Institute this summer and see if we can get hard numbers on how much legal immigrants cost on average, or certain types of legal immigrants, like people from Central America, Africa, Asia. Are they really a net economic net positive? I doubt they are. And of course, I'm more interested in race and culture, but we need to make this argument to people who think about money so that we can get some more breathing time to save our people. But there were a lot of things where they were. So repatriation of legal immigrants is going to be a tough challenge. I think we really need to get the ball rolling on illegal immigrants first, just to get it normalized in people's heads. But there were a lot of policies to encourage illegal immigrants to voluntarily repatriate themselves too, like telling them they can't get a driver's license. That was the most popular thing. Everybody, even a lot of Democrats, agreed with that. And I think it's because a lot of people, these illegal immigrants aren't insured. They cause accidents. The victim is left in a very bad position most of the time. So that's a good one. Also, they're opposed to giving these people a bunch of handouts. And this is big because a lot of legal immigrants get handouts too. For example, a lot of countries, whether they're legal or illegal, will give them stipends. Germany gives migrants stipends. And it's about the same amount that I mentioned in the poll. In California, they're being put up in housing. There's some Catholic charity which works in conjunction with a Jewish organization in San Diego that does this. And they're getting large sums of money for the federal government along the San Diego County to basically house criminal invaders to come and dispossess us. So there goes the economic argument. If they're a boon to the GDP, assuming that all you care about is the GDP like Han Solo, why do we have to pay for their housing? They should pay for that themselves. So this argument falls apart very rapidly. And That's a big thing. If we can show that they are an economic drag, they behave economically just like illegal immigrants, demanding services, causing crime, we can get people accustomed to the idea that they should be kicked out. And one of the questions we asked was if they believe that illegal immigrants or legal resident aliens, we're getting their toes dipped in the pool of deporting legal immigrants here, but this talk of legal aliens, you know, a green card holder, if they commit a felony or plead guilty, if they are convicted of a felony or plead guilty to one, should they be immediately deported to the homeland? A lot of them said yes. It's very high numbers all across the party line. So that was very good.
Well, that's very useful because a lot of them do commit crimes. That's actually quite a useful result. What other things are promising for the legal immigrant?
That's a problem. It is not promising at all. So I'll get to something that is promising. It looks horrible at first, but we need to really address how difficult this is. So for the very first one of the first questions we asked, the one about what's your opinion on illegal immigrants bad, legal immigrants good? Only a very slim minority said that they disagreed with that statement on the grounds that legal immigrants are a net negative. That is a problem. However, this also changed once I presented to the question takers if legal immigrants, if immigration in general, so I didn't say illegal or legal, just if immigration in general is changing the racial demographics of America, how does that affect your support? Does it go up or down? And a lot of people actually, including some Democrats, said it lowered their support for it. So,
that's interesting.
So
yeah.
That's a big deal. So a lot of people, they don't put two and two together. For me, we're all smart people here. I lived in Southern California. I saw this firsthand. Of course, immigrants are changing the racial demographics of America. I'm sorry. It's very obvious that we are not getting a bunch of Ukrainians here. It's like random Hispanics and now Africans and who knows what. It's a bargain bag of not a bargain. It's just all over the place and hardly any white people. So it's obvious they're changing the racial demographics of the country. That should be kind of a dud thing, but we have to spell this out.
Yeah, and Democrats are betting on this and crowing about it and saying it's one of their great successes. And of course, if we don't like it, though, we're guilty of a conspiracy theory. But yeah, it should be obvious to everybody that it is actually happening. But I guess they have to have this doublespeak because there are people who don't approve of this. And of course, back in 1965, when they sold the Hart-Celler immigration reforms, Teddy Kennedy promised the nation it wouldn't change the demographics. If they had said this will change America's demographics dramatically, it wouldn't have been popular. It probably wouldn't have gone through. So it's interesting that there's a percentage of voters who still disapprove of that, even Democrats and independents.
Right. In fact, independents. So I asked two questions. One, their opinion about immigration, assuming that demographics are changing. One, if immigrants tend to identify as or lean Democrat more than Republican. And what's strange is that the Republicans, their little eyes light up when they mention the electorate. They're very, now some of them do oppose it a lot more on, or slightly more on racial issues, on the fact of changing the demographics. It was about 48% opposed it a little more or a lot more if it's changing the demographics. That jumped up to about 60% if it's changing the electoral politics. Independents, they were a little bit more indifferent about the electoral thing, but once he mentioned the demographic question, they opposed it by about 29% opposed immigration a little or a lot more of independent voters. And about only 7% supported it among independents. So some of this, you get more Republican outrage when you mention that it's an electoral issue. And among Democrats and independents, we want to talk about the demographic thing, ironically, because Republicans are already covered by talking about the electoral consequences. So yes, once we actually start to explain, kind of state the duh and the obvious, that this is changing the demographics, this is, you know, also we have studies to cite this now. The Pew Research shows that this is a duh thing, but we need to have our study, of course, to show that we're not just making this up. the cat's out of the bag that they do vote Democrat. That's the whole point. And people are normalizing that like Tucker Carlson. And yes, we would prefer that they say that's a racial thing instead of an electoral thing, but the two kind of go hand together. So by simply bringing this up, we didn't have to give them a whole essay or a YouTube video. This was a one sentence line in here. All of a sudden, they start to sour on immigration. So I think that is very good.
So I'm hearing three things here that we can improve our messaging on. And of course, the broader anti-immigration movement has been saying this for a long time. And I'd like to see more progress on this. But one, we have to emphasize that these people are here to politically disempower the white majority. And the Democrats are very open about this. They're changing the demographics of the country because they want a permanent leftist majority. A lot of people are intimidated by this stupid charge. Oh, it's a conspiracy theory when it's obviously what they're doing. And as long as you approve of it, you can speak about it approvingly. It's just obviously true. It's election tampering. It is vote stealing. It is undermining democracy, because what it is the inverse of the democratic principle of popular sovereignty. In a democracy, the people rule, and the elites have to follow what the people want. That's why we have elections and representation, to make the elites subservient to the people. What we have in this society are elites that don't want to represent the interests of the people, so they are trying to bring in a new people that will vote for the policies that they wish to impose upon us. It is a complete farce. It is a complete inversion of democracy, and we can fight it on those grounds. The other thing is that it is obviously demographic change. It's white dispossession. A lot of white people, consciously or unconsciously, don't like this. We can emphasize that more. It's a very easy point to sell, which is why I guess there's so much doublespeak and lying and gaslighting about this in the mainstream, because the left has nothing to stand on. They just have to tell you, don't believe your lying eyes, don't believe the statistics. And then the third thing, and again, we've in the broader movement have hit on this over and over again, these people are net economic negatives. They do not improve GDP. They are not going to pay for our pensions. They're not doing this at all. The reason why they are being brought in is twofold. One is because the left wants to displace the native population out of power lust and ideology, and also ethnic hate for the wrong kind of white people who don't vote for them. And two, there are business elites who are bringing these people in, not because they enrich society, not because there are these vast banks of human capital or anything like that. These people are not brought in to compete with us on quality. They are brought in to compete on price, meaning they're here to work cheaply, not necessarily as efficiently, but cheaply, and therefore they are lowering our standard of living while also disproportionately accessing government subsidies and so forth. They are net negatives. They will not be paying for your Social Security. They're going to be smothering you in a nursing home because they're annoyed with old white people still living. So, I mean, we can, I guess, there are little seeds where we can see that these messages are sprouting. And I guess we just need to work on refining those messages and getting them out more.
We do. And I think a huge part of that is courting rogue elites, because the left went crazy because Trump kind of touched the third rail of immigration. All we need is somebody to normalize it. For example, a lot of the talk about Jewish power has been normalized on X of all places because Candace Owens and others have touched it, even if they did it very nicely and defensively. Well, that gave everyone else permission to kind of let their hair down and go wild on it. And another few points I'd like to make is that in regards to the use of immigration as an electoral weapon, we have recently leaked audio from Project Veritas of a State Department official explaining that is exactly what is happening. So this is straight from the horse's mouth. So I might use that to inspire a poll question or two in the future to really see if that affects people. And two, talking about the economic effects of immigration, a lot of it You know, crime causes economic damage, of course. You have broken stores, they take your, they steal your car parts. This is all a problem. So there are direct impacts, but there's a lot of indirect impacts because this clogs up the legal system. You now have a bunch of people with felonies and misdemeanors, and this simply clogs up the courts. And all these people are entitled to a public defender. They have these huge rap sheets, which kill paper. All these cases have paperwork. And at some point, this this simply stresses the judiciary, which has limited resources and is still recovering from the COVID era. I feel like a lot of courts, they're still kind of backed up from COVID. Even without that, this would still be consuming judicial resources. And so normal defendants and victims want to, you know, the defendant needs to get their case handled so they can go on with life finally. The victim needs to get justice. Well, they have to wait because all these legal cases caused by immigrants, both legal and illegal. So this is a losing proposition. It's unjust. It's also costly. And another way that immigration costs a lot of money, and this is a little bit speculative, but it's in line with sound economic principles, that's probably retarded innovation. You see, by allowing cheap labor to flow everywhere, there's less of an incentive to go to automation robotics for agriculture work and other types of labor. And yet there's been all these great strides made in this field, like with drones that are driven by AI. I prefer to say advanced computing, AC, because it's not artificial intelligence. I know you've discussed that before, where AI, true AI, is something horrendous, while this is simply advanced computing and programming, but it looks fancy, so people think it's AI. This is not abominable intelligence from Warhammer 40K. It's simply advanced computing, but tomato, tomato for the time being. Well, we could have had our farm labor done by robots already, or machines, or AI. But why do it?
We could have had our lawns being done by robots, too. We could have had leaf blowers that just power themselves around without Hispanics holding on to them. Exactly. There's sound economic principle behind this. And we find, historically speaking, that during periods of high labor costs, there is an incentive for automation, for investing in improved capital, improved technology, as opposed to times when labor is cheap and it just makes sense to do it in an old-fashioned, cheap way, hand labor, stoop labor in the fields rather than a high-tech way. And we have unstrung one of the primary incentives towards innovation. And this really has been the case since the end of the Cold War. That was one of the major factors, I think, that made the post-war era a great time for working white people. From 1945 to the mid-70s, that was a great time for working white people. And there was some globalization that started happening because, well, détente basically started ramping down the Cold War in the early 70s, the opening to China, things like that. And without that superpower competition, our capitalist classes could get a little bit greedy and unserious. But when communism ended, basically by 1991, by the 90s were the time when globalization just took off. And globalization increases productivity, in quotes, not by improving technology, but by cutting costs. And so you had all these people paying themselves huge bonuses and dividends for being more profitable when all they were doing was basically debasing the labor pool by globalizing, by opening the borders to immigrants coming in, by shipping factories overseas and so forth. And we have been seeing for more than a generation now, rapid deindustrialization and people getting phenomenally wealthy while at the same time basically causing technological progress to stagnate, except in computing. And this is just, it's taken us off the upward path that we were on during the Cold War, the sort of Faustian upward technological path, and has turned things more towards the third world style plantation economy with cheap labor. And of course, the third world provides endless numbers of people who can debase Western living standards. And of course, with complete open borders, complete globalization, economics 101 predicts that there will be a leveling out of labor prices, that we will lose a great deal and the third world will gain a little bit, until basically Western societies are immiserated for the marginal benefit of the third world and the enormous benefit of the oligarchs. It's just a dystopian outcome.
Right. This is extremely arrogant because this is all driven by a linear understanding of time, and they thought they were in the end of history where they could simply go wild and not have consequences, and that enemies would not pop up eventually, and that their silly golden order of debt-based spending and globalism will last forever. And guess what? That didn't happen. There was changes in technology. People pushed back. They got weak. Other people got stronger. And it was just pure arrogance. And I saw, I forget who said it, but somebody somewhere on social media said that in hindsight, the 90s were a going away party for white people. The powers that be decide, well, we can just do white genocide now. We can simply replace them because we don't need them to fight the Soviet Union. And guess what? Mm-hmm. There are other powers at home and abroad that are going to say, no, you're not outside of history. There's no end to this. And these people were simply arrogant and stupid and apparently never read a real history book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about national divorce. That was one of the topics. One of my hopes is that we can have peaceful separation of different parts of the country. Red states, which sort of are a proxy for white states, and blue states, which are heavily non-white, may be able to go their separate ways. I don't know who's going to win the presidential election, but we know with absolute certainty that half the country will think the result is illegitimate. There is such polarization now that nobody is going to be satisfied with the outcome of this election. We have, as AOC said, irreconcilable differences. There are irreconcilable differences between AOC and Nick Fuentes, she says. And if you have irreconcilable differences, well, that's cause for no-fault divorce. And I would love to see national divorce. And one of the fault lines that I think can bring this about has to do with immigration. So can you talk a little bit about how attitudes towards immigration might lay the groundwork for national divorce in one way or another?
Yes. So towards the end of the poll, I asked how people were in favor of defying government in regards to immigration. I asked it from both angles. Say if there were pro-immigration policies coming down from courts or the executive or president, and the same if there were anti-immigration politics coming down. And the particular question about national divorce, I asked, if Biden is elected and enacts pro-immigration policies, what's your opinion on states who disagree leaving via national divorce, a peaceful national divorce? And I asked the same thing, but with Trump being elected and enacting anti-immigration policies, even though given recent remarks, it seems like he'll be doing a lot of pro-immigration policies too. And I found that the numbers did not change based upon the scenario very much, or even across party lines. So that really shows that national divorce is not tied to electoral fortunes. It's not a matter of I'm a sore loser, as some people might try to say. It's really there are irreconcilable differences, and people realize that we'd all be better off if we simply separated. For example, with Donald Trump being elected and acting horrible anti-immigration policies that would make liberals cry, 18% of Democrats, 23% of independents, and 39.5% of Republicans would support pro-immigration states leaving through a peaceful national divorce. Well, those numbers are basically the same if I ask next, if Joe Biden is reelected and enacts pro-immigration policies, he already is, 19.7% of Democrats, 21.7% of independents, and 35.2% of Republicans would support anti-immigration states leaving through a peaceful national divorce. So that's big, and that might seem strange, but it's good because it shows that national divorce is an independent policy position. It's not just tied to immigration or specific issues. It's more of a mindset. People either agree and understand that we need to have a national divorce or they don't. And the fact that it was that high is very good. I'll find, let me find the number for all of them. So that was about 18% of all respondents of, so basically 18% of all white voters would support a national divorce if there is a showdown between the states and the federal government. So that's really what this question, where it came down to. It wasn't what I thought would be where there'd be a difference. It really just came down to if there's a showdown, doesn't matter if this is blue on red or red on blue, Trump beating up Vermont, who wants to keep their all 20 of their Somalis that they worship, or Joe Biden disagreeing with Texas again about barbed wire. The number of people who think that is a good solution is independent of the specific facts. They simply get that we will never agree on this, regardless of who's in power, and we should have a national divorce. That shows that the national divorce thing isn't going anywhere. This cannot be tampered down by a, you know, letting steam off. You know, there was there's always a doubt that these ideas could be sabotaged by a slow boil again, where people are allowed to go back to normalcy. Like, if Trump is elected, maybe people will cool off a little bit. And that's not true. And now people understand the national divorce thing isn't something that can be sabotaged by letting people get some steam off. It's simply going to be there. It's highly resilient.
That's interesting. One result that I thought was really sobering. Well, there are two results in this poll that I thought were sobering. One is that what people think is a quintessential boomer meme, that, well, legal immigrants are okay, but it's just the illegals we need to worry about. Actually, younger people hold that view as well. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so everybody always says, as long as they come here legally, is a boomer meme. And I know our polls have dispelled some misconceptions in the past about gender and politics. And this is one of the other meme kind of myths or memes that we've dispelled, just like how the internal movement poll dispelled the myth that we're autistic, we're actually INTJ sigma males. No, well, here, this is actually slightly more popular amongst the youth. And now I do have to put some caveats here. I didn't control for the different age brackets with all their subcategories as tightly as I controlled for white people overall. However, I did keep a closer eye on the 18 to 29 for certain types of characteristics. So there's still a lot of suggested value to this. And especially if it was a boomer meme, you wouldn't think it would be going in the opposite direction. And so what this means is that I did find this very troubling because in Europe, the backlash to immigration is being caused by the youth. For example, there is a huge drop in support for the Green Party amongst young voters and a huge surge amongst AfD in Germany. And the youth are very good in America on other issues. For example, even though their support for LGBT degeneracy is very high, there is a significant drop in that recently or over the past decade or so. I think since 2016, if I recall correctly. And so this is a tad odd. And I think what this comes down to is that it's simply very much baked into the culture. Maybe older people, they're either louder about this, or what I really think is why it's considered a boomer meme is because pundits who are associated with boomers, like Alex Jones, Glenn Beck, of all people, he's always crying and sobbing. These people who we associate with boomers and have a large older audience, they're the ones who really, really toot this really, really loudly. And so that's why we associate it with boomers. It's actually the older people who simply have an older audience are very loud about it. But really, it's just as strong, if not stronger, amongst the youth. And therefore, we need to really dig into why this is a problem. And I think I kind of touched on this before, but some other issues I think they're driving this problem amongst the youth is that people, too many Americans identify with immigrants, which is bad because if you look at the white immigrants of the 1800s, early 1900s, they had it rough. They had to either conquer, settle, pioneer, or even if they didn't do those things, they had a relatively easy life. It's still rough in America. There were from certain segments of immigrants, there was something like a third would go back home because America was too difficult for them. There were Irish during the Irish potato famine who would go back home to Ireland because it's too tough in America. That's how bad it was. And so there was very little to no safety net. There's no affirmative action or welfare or social program. There's no free medical insurance like California gives to illegal immigrants now. You gotta work hard. And if you couldn't make it, you starved and went back home. And that, to compare the immigrant of today who is entitled, non-white, has preferable treatment to the native-born in many cases, is simply insulting to our ancestors. And there's a false equivalency here. And I think we really need to hammer home how our ancestors, there is simply no difference. Once we get past the fact that both groups moved, they're completely different. That's the only thing they have in common, is that they moved to America. All similarities end after that point. And there's other issues too. I think part of the problem is that the youth simply are growing up among more non-whites. I saw this in California. I was surrounded by diversity growing up, and that was a prelude to the rest of the country. The rest of the country is now following my high school experience, unfortunately, and that might be letting people's guard down in regards to understanding that this is the other. In Europe, all these migrants, these are completely new. They're completely new to the community. There's no, despite all these really bizarre attempts to cast Britain as like full of black people until, I don't know, the 1800s, like, talk about, there were black Romans here, therefore you should have all Africans in it. Are you kidding me? But, or the Windrush thing that they're always going on about. They really are new to Europe, and people know this, and they're not accustomed. There was no slow boil with, okay, we'll have some Poles and Hungarians with unpronounceable names like me come in, and then, oh, let's have some Mexicans in California, Arizona, and Texas, and then, oh, let's have infinity Africans from Africa. There's less of a slow boil in Europe, because all of a sudden with the migrant crisis, there's more pushback there, while in America, people might not have that, you know, they might be a little bit more used to this. We need to push back. This is bad. I really want to bring up a point that my friend Christian Seeker made. He's a January 6th defendant. He began writing for us. In his essay, it was, I believe it's called The Nation of Theseus. He said, yes, okay, you liberals are correct to some extent. America has a history of immigration. But we need to stop reinventing ourselves. If we're constantly in a state of becoming, we're just going to disappear. At some point, we need to say, stop. Yes, this was in the past. It cannot go on forever and ever, or else we will go extinct. We'll not be the same. It's not sustainable. This is probably all a mistake. So we need to maybe admit the point, but say, I don't care. In fact, this is a bad thing. We need to stop changing. We need to quit becoming and simply be.
Yeah, that's very nicely put. There is another differential that I have harped on for years, which has to do with emotional intensity. And it was very interesting to see the actual polling data that showed me what I believed to be true all along, which is, and it's based on Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, where he says, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Well, the best who lack conviction are the center right, and the worst who are passionately intense are the left. And all things being equal, if one group lacks conviction and another group is fired up and emotionally intense, the more emotionally intense party is going to win. And it was interesting looking at the poll results, because there is an indication that the left has a lot more emotional intensity on these issues than the right does. And so I guess you can comment on the numbers, but let's also comment on how do we overcome that differential, because that is the key to success.
Right. So that's a huge problem. Conservatives want to conserve the money, and nationalists want to conserve the nation. And the issue is that white people are not nationalists. Even civic nationalists are not very nationalistic. So the Republican respondents, they'd get very emotional when it involved money in this poll. That's where you saw the emotional intensity, because I'd ask a lot of questions strongly or slightly agree or support or oppose. And Democrats were very, very emotional about immigration in regards to cultural enrichment, agreeing that there are net positive. Republicans were more likely to say slightly instead of strongly on these questions. That's dangerous, because all things being equal, if these two powers collide, the one that really wants it and will go up in arms about will get it. And this is a problem with the green card policy that Trump has proposed. if those of us who dislike immigration are just kind of wishy-washy, like, yeah, I wish there were fewer of them, but oh, I want my tax break. I want to, you know, bomb the Palestinians and live my nationalist fantasies vicariously through Israel, people. Well, and they go up against these Democrats who gush and cry and whine and wail because of a staged photo op of a kid in barbed wire and this revel in slave morality and hysteria and SSRIs all day long. Well, the hysterical emotional faction will overcome the tepid faction every single time. And this kind of gets, I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but the whole zero seats thing, pushing back against green cards, like, and this just isn't just also immigration. We see this with the abortion debate. The pro-life lobby, and as I'm going to call them, the daddy issue lobby, both parties have to pander to them because they're hyper-emotional, and they dare not upset these people because they might sit out the election. They won't vote for their side. Like, no Bible-thumping Republican is going to vote Democrat because a Republican went weak on abortion. But they might stay home. And they also volunteer and donate a lot, and they might withhold those things to candidates who are weak. Well, the anti-immigration lobby, the America First lobby or faction, needs to be just like the abortion, the pro-life lobby and the daddy issue lobby, and say, no, we're not going to vote. We might not vote for dark Brandon and vote for white replacement that way, but we're not going to vote for white replacement but Trump either. If this comes down to a question of Biden replacing us with illegal Mexicans and Cheeto Bush replacing us with legal Indians, I'm not playing your stupid game. I'm going to legitimize this farcical anti-white liberal democracy. I'm going to sit home, and if I before anybody to me for Jar Jar Binks.
Right. Well, this brings us to your most recent piece, which is about not wanting to vote for Bush because of this green card thing. So, folks, if you have questions and comments, we very much appreciate them. And we even more appreciate them if they're connected with a super chat, because that helps us with our fundraiser. This year, we are trying to raise $300,000 to keep Countercurrents going and also make things better. And to do that, we need your help. Now, there are a couple ways you can do it. You can go to Entropy and you can take out your credit card and leave a super chat donation and a question. We will get to all of those in the course of the stream. Another thing you can do is send a tip through Odyssey. And again, we very much appreciate that. And we will get to that in the course of the stream. And we do have one question here.
Well, before you ask it, I'd like to piggyback off, be like an NCO and piggyback off what you said. Trump's reversal on the green card issue was most likely due to Jewish donors pushing him towards that direction, towards Israel. And so politics requires money. It's an unfortunate fact. Oswald Spengler talks about this. But you can help fight back by donating to us. You can, look, it's the meme of, look, I'm the donor now. You can help fund pushback against these subversive mega donors. And your money will go a lot further because we will make better use of it.
Yeah, that's really nicely put. Thank you. Archie writes in with $3 through Odyssey. And he says, recently Trump was on All In, which is a podcast, and asked about attaching a green card to a university diploma. He approved, yet years ago, Trump said that the H-1B visa was horrible and he wanted it eliminated. And he actually got rid of it during his administration. And of course, it was immediately restored by Joe Biden. Is there a difference between the H-1B visa and a diploma having a green card stapled to it? Now, another person also writes in, this is on Entropy, and asks about the same thing. It's Jasper, who sends $200. Whoa. Thank you very much. That's extremely generous. We really appreciate it. He sends $200 and he says, David Zutty recently announced he will probably abstain from voting in the upcoming election. This is due to the green card thing. Greg, do you agree or disagree with this strategy? So let's talk about this. This green card thing is basically the great replacement that has been packaged to appeal to bourgeois conservatives who value things like education. These people are strivers, right? They're coming here and striving and getting degrees. They're not just coming across the border to pick vegetables and rake lawns. These are quality people. This is elite human capital, right?
Not like the Black Scare who twerk on ambulances.
Yeah, exactly. It appeals to their snobbery, even though they will be loath to admit that that's actually going on. This was a dead idea for a long time. I think Mitt Romney talked about it way back when, more than a decade ago, when he was running for president. Charlie Kirk endorsed this thing before he became sensible and based. And it's just a really dumb thing. Again, it's tempting to call it a boomer meme, but it's probably polls very well amongst younger people too. And Trump had no reason to come out with this nonsense. And it certainly doesn't help him with his base. It certainly doesn't help him in you know, the swing states, where we've seen the results of more than basically two generations of deindustrialization and collapse on the white working class. And now he's siding with the bosses in the white collar businesses that want to replace you with cheaper labor from India or something like that. This is idiotic. This is an own goal. This is not going to help him at all. He's siding with the bosses who want to replace you with somebody cheap. And of course, they want to dress this up by talking about if they work hard enough to get an associate's degree at a community college, they deserve to be rewarded with a green card staple to the diploma. That's just rubbish. This is the great replacement ratcheting up a level economically and coming for white collar jobs, professional jobs. And there should be pushback against this. Now, there was pushback against the H-1B visa stuff, and Trump listened to that and actually did the right thing. Could we have some pushback on this and maybe wake Trump up? It's worth trying. You know, we are a movement. We're a set of the population. I wish we knew exactly how large. Folks, we don't know how large because we don't have the infrastructure yet to do that level of polling. And that's because our movement has foolishly not invested in that kind of infrastructure for decades. Instead, we've been doing stuff that's less effective and less serious. And we need to actually invest to create that kind of infrastructure so we know these things. There was all this loose, frankly, drunken talk about memeing Trump into the White House in 2016. There was no proof of that. We hoped it was true, and we wanted people to believe that it was true. And the Manosphereian types who think that politics is all faking it, they tried to meme it into existence by going around and very confidently stating this. It was rubbish. It was BS. We don't know, and no serious politician will take that kind of unsourced, factless claim seriously. If we want to be a political force to be reckoned with, we need to give them numbers that they can reckon with, and we don't have the numbers. Now, maybe the establishment has a better idea, and probably, in fact, do have a better idea of how many of us are out there than we do. But they're not going to announce that fact. They want to keep that secret. It's like the ancient Romans. They didn't want the slaves to be able to recognize one another in the streets of Rome, lest they realize they're the majority, right? They want to keep us in the dark about our own strength, and we have not invested in the infrastructure to find that out. But let's just leave that aside. It's still worth a try to flex our muscles as a group. We've seen that we can inject our memes into the mainstream. It's happened with the Great Replacement. It's happened with National Divorce. We might try to meme up a storm of opposition to this stupid green card scheme and just see if there's any results to that. Because I know for a fact that a lot of people saw this and just said, God, you know, he's so retarded. You know, he's just so retarded. What do we do here? I'm out. A lot of people just said, I'm out, right? I am not going to invest any hope in this Cheeto buffoon because he's just so damn clueless. And well, he's like a weathercock. The wind blows one way and he follows it. Maybe if we huff and we puff, he'll swing in the opposite direction. It's worth a try, even if we don't really know how strong we are. We'll never really know how strong we are until we actually exert some strength and see if we can push the political spectrum around, push politicians around. Ultimately, we want to be a force that politicians fear. And I guess one of the ways of doing that is the way you put it. I'm out. I'm not going to vote for this buffoon. If it's going to be the great replacement Joe Biden style or the great replacement Bush style, Cheeto Bush style, Trump style, green card style, I don't have a dog in this fight. And I'm not going to expend the effort to follow this election, get emotionally invested in it, you know, and go out and pull the lever. I'm just not going to do it. And a lot of people probably feel the same way. If enough people feel that way, then it's something that the establishment, namely Trump, needs to take into account. And maybe that'll change policy. So, you know, I think it's a sincere attitude on the part of a lot of people like yourself. But even if you don't want to play it sincere, even if you want to play it in a Machiavellian way, you can simply say that the more people who say, I'm out, I'm done, screw this guy, the better, because that means that they will have to take these voters into account. And another way I like to put it is in terms of the politics of spite. The system gets us always back, right? Voting, trying to vote harder this time and get our, you know, maybe the GOP will save us this time. They always try and get us back because they appeal to rational self-interest. They think, well, you know, as long as there's a dime's worth of difference, a microscopic line between the center left and the center right, we can get some of these people on the right to pull the Republican lever one more time for the lesser of two evils, for, you know, a tiny little change in the formula of the snake oil or the poison that everyone's selling. And they get people to do it because it seems like the rational and responsible thing to do. Well, there's something that overcomes rational self-interest, and that is spite. And, you know, spite is basically saying, I don't care, I just want to hurt you. I want to hurt you, and I don't care if it hurts me. I don't care if it hurts me more than it hurts you. You have done me wrong, I am through being nice, and I'm going to headbutt you. You know, you see headbutting in like fights in movies. I've never seen it in real life. You see headbutting and you think, how is that any worse on the person you hit than yourself, right? You know, it's like, this doesn't seem like a very effective form of fighting. You're just as likely to knock yourself silly as your enemy. But anyway, it makes sense from the point of view of engaged thumos and spite, where you just... it's just, you're going to do it because fuck you. And if enough people vote that way, if enough people out of spite throw away the rational self-interest argument, that does actually, in the long term, redound to their rational self-interest because it makes them a threat to the establishment. And if the establishment can't basically rationally corral them in, they simply have to appease these people. And in short, maybe we should start being a little less rational and a little less responsible and be the kind of people who hold these people's political careers hostage, like the emotionally intense fanatics in the pro-life movement, for instance. These people hold the Republican Party and their careers hostage. They cannot get what they want for their billionaire donors and Israel if they cross these fanatics. And we have to be, until we are the majority, we have to be the fanatical kinds of minorities that they fear and cater to. And so those are some of my thoughts on this. Personally, I want Bush to win, but I want him to earn it. And the way he's going to earn it is he's going to endure some pushback from angry people like us who feel very strongly about these things, so strongly that we are willing to sit this election out just to punish betrayal like he's engaged in recently. Thoughtless, stupid betrayal. Because again, you look at this and you think, even if he walks this back, it's a character issue. It does not augur well for anything else the guy does. So, David, what are your thoughts on this?
Right. So this is a perennial issue with Trump where he changes all the time. And for example, probably the biggest example of this was towards the end of his first term, there was a issue with Iran. There was a question, there were missiles hitting Iraq. There was a question if Trump would escalate and risk broader regional conflict. And people were praying for blood, all the neocons like Bolton. And then Tucker Carlson had to get on a plane, fly across several time zones, and talk some sense into Trump. And that worked. And here's the problem with Trump. It comes down to whoever spoke with him last. Like, for example, the green card thing is followed quickly on the tails of him shaking hands and talking with Miriam Adelson, who is the widow of Sheldon Adelson, a major Jewish Zionist donor. And he was also schmoozing with other Zionist Jewish donors. And I'm sure if it wasn't Miriam, it is one of them, probably told him this. This came out of left field after he was talking about immigrant, you know, at least illegal immigrants poisoning the blood of our country. So I don't have 100% proof, but I think we've gone from reasonable suspicion to I think more likely than not that that is what happened. And so at this point, just like Congress has all these little AIPAC babysitters to manage them, if Trump gets elected, we're going to need Tucker Carlson to have a full-time job of being a nationalist babysitter for Trump. And he might as well just move to the White House and hold his hand, because Trump cannot be trusted not to make a bad decision based upon what some Jew told him last week. And that is very dangerous. That is not that is the opposite of a leader. That is a follower in the worst sense possible. And this isn't tenable. At some point, like you said, it speaks to his character. It really does. Like this, if he was a serious candidate, a good candidate, he would not have proposed this at all. This should be unthinkable. This should be like one of these pro-life or abortion advocates, you know, getting fussy about someone mentioning overturning Roe versus Wade. This should not be thinkable. And I'm gonna act like those people do, because they get their biscuits buttered pretty hard by both sides all the time.
Yeah,
this is ridiculous, and it just isn't tenable. And I think there should be another Graper War. You know, Nick Fuentes, people love him or hate him, but he's on the Senate right now. He really made his name by the first Graper War. I think he should do another Graper War. I know he already basically kind of did it by calling out AFPAC. I mean, not AFPAC, but CPAC. I know it was Turning Point USA. That was where his event was adjacent to. But really to say, like, we'll do it again. Because this is
Let's not wait for Fuentes. I mean, other people can organize this and do this. But yeah, there needs to be pushback in public forums. The way to do it is to have people who get up and ask questions pointedly about this and show some emotional intensity, and then seed the crowd with other people who will second what they're saying, applaud it, agree with it, and create the feeling that everywhere around you, there is a groundswell of opposition for this stupid idea. That's how we do this. It's political theater, but it's solid political theater. So we should be doing stuff like that. Yeah, it's very disturbing. Trump isn't a leader. I remember years ago, some washed up alt-right e-celeb that people were acclaiming as a leader for a while, we don't even need to mention names, said something really, really stupid. And I made a comment on it. And not long after this, somebody popped up and was doing reply guy stuff. It's like, well, actually, you know, he's a thoughtful guy, and he was just thinking out loud. And maybe he didn't really believe this. And here's another, it was basically some flunky was coming in and trying to clean up the mess that their quote-unquote leader had created. And my response to this guy was, if he needs you to clean up his mess, then you should be the leader, not him. What's going on here? And we look at somebody like Trump. Trump is not a leader. People think of him as a leader. They look up to him as a leader. But he's constantly shitting the bed.
He's a glorified hype man and a real estate agent. This is real estate tactics, talking stuff up and then changing the deal and being, he's a New York sleazebag. He's really adopted a lot of Jewish big business, you know, mannerisms and customs that just like talk big and betray the contract. He needs, at this point, Tucker should be president, not Trump, because that's the person who is making the good decisions, or at least trying to. Just like we should have all these little APAC babysitters just from Congress, not national congressmen. It'd be more efficient and honest.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. But my feeling is that I would like to see a groundswell of opposition. I'd like to see more and more people say, look, if there's not a dime's worth of difference between Trump and Biden, we're going to stay home. And that could swing the election. It's going to be very close, and it's going to be very close, and it's going to come down to seven states. Again, I wish we knew how many of our guys were in those seven states and how many of them are willing to think ahead and say, we might be willing to sit this out to punish these people. Now, this brings me to another thing, which is zero seats in the UK. The UK Conservative Party, I think it's the oldest political party in the modern world. And it is on the brink of destruction. And next week, we are going to have a stream. I've invited Morgoth and some other people on, some of our UK constituents. And we're going to talk about zero seats because that is the stream before the UK election. The UK Conservative Party has been run by a cavalcade of pinheaded dwarves recently, absolute idiots. And they basically only care about money. And they raised up a crop of diverse frontmen, basically, people who were ambitious and thought, well, I've got the right credentials. I'm rich. I went to the right schools. I'm ambitious. Why shouldn't I be PM? Why shouldn't I be in the running for PM? And I'm a woman, or I'm brown, right? And so you got these ambitious brown and female mediocrities pushing themselves forward in a vacuum where white men were saying, yes, this is great. We'll show that we're not racist. We'll just take out some Rishi Sunak insurance. And that was a very, very expensive policy to take out because the guy was a disaster. And who was before him? Some brainless woman whose name I've forgotten already. So they basically allowed affirmative action and wokeness and shallowness. Because again, there's a significant number of center-right people who basically would love to find Caitlyn Jenner's or Rishi Sunak's to basically be spokespersons for oligarchy and yet also tick off certain PC identity boxes. Because these people are so unimaginative and foolish that they think that they can somehow win in a game that's stacked against them, which is the whole system of political correctness is stacked against the right. And they think, well, we don't want to challenge the system. We can play along. We can get what we really want, which is tax cuts for billionaires and what oligarchs like. We can get what we really want and be totally PC. And they're right.
And there's a convergence. This will always triggers the libs. Yeah. And then the uneducated voter thinks, well, because my enemies think it's horrible and are crying about it, well, that means this is Caitlyn Jenner is a great thing, or Bruce Jenner. And I was like, no, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, yeah. And so what they did is they basically went woke. They put forward these mediocrities, these ambitious brown and female mediocrities who were not up to the job, who allowed immigration to go absolutely amok in the aftermath of COVID, when the last thing you need is a million people showing up on your shores. It has been a total disaster. And now, because I think Sunak should be on suicide watch at this point. His behavior is so irrational. He called the snap election. This is extremely foolish. And it's like the poor guy, he just wants out. He's a rich oligarchical baby who thought he could play prime minister. And he just wants out. He feels trapped and he wants out. But the party is polling very, very badly. And my dream is they get zero seats. And that's the meme, right? Our comrades in the UK are memeing zero seats everywhere. Farage got into the race, which is great because a lot of people would not stay home or vote Labour, but they will vote for Farage. And that could get the Conservative Party votes down more. I have a beatific vision of the oldest center-right party in the world, the oldest political party in the world being obliterated in a couple of weeks. And this should be a lesson to people on the center right all around the white world. There's a story that cracked me up about Tallulah Bankhead, who was an actress and very talented actress and, you know, a pill popper and an alcoholic and a slut. And she ended up with some kind of multiple venereal diseases or something like that and had to have a hysterectomy. And after the whole thing was over and she was conferring with the doctor, she awakened from the anesthesia and the doctor came in. She says, "I hope you don't think this has taught me a lesson," which is just totally her, right? Well, I hope that this actually does teach the conservatives around the world a lesson. And it would be very, very useful to have the death of the UK Conservative Party to dangle in front of the Republicans, because that would be enormously encouraging to people on the radical right everywhere, because this zero seats meme is coming from our circles. And because of the parliamentary system, because of the Farage wild card, and just because of the utter stupidity of these people, it's actually a possibility. They could slip from being the number one party to the number three or four party. If they slip to number four, what you're going to see is big donors leaving. You're going to see candidates and, you know, consultants and people like that jumping ship. The UK Conservative Party probably does not have billions in dollars like a university in an endowment that can allow them to just be retarded until the sun burns out. If they don't perform, they're going to lose donations and they're going to not have the cash flow to keep going. They might lose a lot of staff and then other people will leave and then they might just shrink up and it might not kill them right away, but it will destroy the careers of a lot of cuck politicians. And I want to see these people's lives ruined. I want to see their futures canceled. And then I think we can treat this as a fetish that we can brandish. We can brandish the decapitated head of the UK Conservative Party in the United States and other places around and say, let this be a lesson to you, right? Let this be a lesson to you. So I'm really hoping that this happens, because I do think that, first of all, the memes are coming from our sphere. The far right will be blamed / credited for this. And it's going to enormously increase our credibility in other countries as well.
Right. And going back to not knowing how many of our guys there are, I do think there, I might try to popularize a meme of a de facto white nationalist, where they're not us, but they're receptive to our messaging. Like you said, it was our guys who are spearheading the zero seats. Well, a lot of people who may disagree with us on certain things might be receptive to that message nonetheless. And if you look at the 60s, most people were not Jews or communists. But a lot of hippies, and there were a lot of hippies going around back there listening to the Beatles and growing their hair long and all that and smoking pot. They acted like good little foot soldiers of the Communist Party. Even though they were definitely the non-communist left, they actually despised the communists because they were violent. For example, the term tanky that was popularized after the tragedy of 1956 when the Soviets butchered my people. And all these hardcore leftists, they kind of recoiled from that. They still acted like good little commies in regards to subverting their countries. Well, we can do the same thing. Most people may not identify as white nationalist, griper, whatever you want to call it, whatever labels you like, but they might be very receptive to our messages and they might be good little foot soldiers of our movement if we get to them. And we have control of X now. So I think that definitely can happen.
Yeah, in terms of X, I mean, we have a free speech advocate in control of X and we can basically do all the rest. And I've been saying this for a while, but folks, if you're not on X, get on X. It's extremely fun. And we can see a lot of progress happening there. Interesting networking opportunities are taking place. Interesting memes are taking place. We're getting a network effect, a synergies like existed in 2016. It's a very exciting time. If you have an account that was banned, every month, put it on your calendar. The same time you pay your credit card bill or your utility bill, spend 5 minutes logging into your old X account and send them a message saying, this account was banned under the bad old Dorsey regime before Elon Musk for me simply exercising my First Amendment rights. And you might have been doing a little bit more than that, but they're not going to read through every goddamn tweet. they're going to look at this and they might reinstate your account. I got one of my accounts reinstated for doing that. And another thing, though, you have to do is you can't just trust them to email you and let you know. I got an email. I posted a request to have my account unbanned, took a walk, and when I got home, I had an email waiting for me saying my account was back. It was very fast. But I've known people who didn't get an email at all, but they logged in and found that their account was working again. And for some reason, they didn't get an email, or maybe it was sent to an old address. I don't know. But you've got to check the account. You can't just wait to hear from them. You go back and check it from time to time too. Get back on X because a lot of stuff is happening there and it's actually very useful. So yeah, and if we have freedom of speech, we can do all the rest. And we have significantly more freedom of speech now on that platform. In fact, I'm liking it so much that I'm actually not calling it Twitter as much. I'm actually getting comfortable just calling it X. So let's look at some more questions here. Folks, if you want to send a question along with the super chat, we very much appreciate that. 617 Squadrons Dog writes in with $3. Can you give your thoughts on state broadcasters like the BBC, CBC, RTE, TVE, etc.? Do you agree with these in principle? Would you support cutting their funding, if so, completely or just partially? That's an interesting question. Since we have seen that the non-state media is just as cozy with the state as state-owned media, the free market argument against it, that this gives us greater freedom of speech and so forth, doesn't really fly, actually. I don't think there's any reason not to have state media. I just think that there should be non-state media as well. There should be freedom to have other media platforms. Of course, we have the internet now, which levels the playing field in all kinds of ways. But still, I think it is not a bad thing to have state media. Why? Well, for the same reason that in the 19th century, Matthew Arnold, who is a great English poet and also critic, argued for a state church. He has this book called Culture and Anarchy, where he argues against the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland, which was the Protestant church, the Anglican church in Ireland. And there was talk of disestablishing it, making it not the official state church, but just any old private institution. And the point that he made was simply this. Churches that have to compete for people to sit in the pews will bastardize their message. They'll make it touchy-feely, right? Because they have to run after people. They'll have rock and roll music on stage. Of course, he couldn't imagine something that vulgar, but you know, the principle is there. There'll be a race to the bottom to vulgarize and popularize religion. It'll become more touchy-feely, less austere. Certain dogmas that frighten people will be basically set aside, because why scare the consumers away? And it'll just become a kind of feel-good community center thing with uplifting messages and stuff to help you as a producer in modern society, or help you have sexual gratification or a better marriage, all that kind of stuff. Basically, if they have to appeal to the self-interest of the people who sit in the pews, it's going to become capitalized. It'll become a marketing thing. And competition causes decline. Well, that's true in culture in general. And therefore, I do think that we need to have state-subsidized high cultural institutions that do not need to vulgarize everything, bring the masses in. Instead of pandering to people as they are in their ignorance and sloth, we need institutions that uphold high standards and demand that people stretch themselves, so that they can appreciate it. We need edifying cultural institutions, not pandering, popular, feel-good cultural institutions. Because edifying institutions, things that cause us to develop ourselves in terms of our character, in terms of our taste, in terms of our knowledge, that's at the core of what every healthy society should have. And the trouble with putting everything on a capitalist basis is it just becomes a race to the bottom to get more and more people by being less and less demanding and more vulgar. And so I do think that it's good to have an official state opera house, you know, state universities, state cultural institutions in general, as long as they maintain high standards. The trouble with all of these state institutions, of course, is they've been captured by the left. These institutions that are supposed to be the guardians and citadels and the high priests of high culture have been captured by people who basically are enemies of civilization. And so I guess my view of this is that we need to keep these institutions, but we need to clear out everybody who's in them currently, or almost everybody who's in them. We basically need to chase all the woke and PC and leftist people out of there and replace them with people who actually uphold high standards of culture. So, David, do you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I think a big question here comes, it depends on whether we're talking about a Platonic Republic in general, like in the future, or today. I completely agree with Greg. In a Platonic Republic, say when we have power, or there's a different system, or national divorce. But right now, the way I see state media is that there's a problem of an entrenched bureaucracy where unless the ruling party simply sacks everybody involved, all the people who are there are going to be either leftists or center-rightists, and they're going to basically give you pushback. For example, if a bunch of nationalists were to win elections in Britain, would the BBC go right-wing? I think that'd be very difficult and unlikely unless they completely made it a new BBC at that point. So, but the left, they're happy to hire and fire, and they have control over the journalist class, the media. So in the current era of the regimes that we have, I'm opposed to state media because it's simply using state taxpayer money to fund their own replacement in yet another way. At least make the millionaires and billionaires pay, you know, throw money at some silly thing like The Atlantic or Vice News. Because that's what BBC is. It's simply a more, it had a greater air of neutrality once upon a time and more professionality, but it's anti-white. It's extremely leftist. It's really no different than The Atlantic or BBC. It's simply a different flavor of the same thing. These people all subscribe to the same ideology. Mm-hmm. So right now, as a practical answer, I'd say just get rid of it completely. But in the future, have it where the ruling party actually is the state media of the state, of the nation, of the ruling party, not of an entrenched liberal caste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can agree with that. We would have to clear them out, as the Bowden meme says, which I love. Clear them out and zero seats are two great memes, and I hope they actually bear fruit in the near future in the UK. So we have a couple more questions here. Folks, get the questions in. We've got about 30 minutes to go. I think this is going really well. So Wizard Squirrel writes in with $20. Thank you very much. That's a new name to me. Let's read this question. I found out about Countercurrents through Greg Johnson's recent discussion with Arvel. I'm now a CC fan. Well, this is great. This is why I go on other people's streams. Arvel and I had a discussion about Plato and Platonism. And he's a big Plato fan and fan of Neoplatonism. He's a very, very intelligent guy and phenomenally articulate and really well-versed in late Neoplatonic philosophy / theology. I'm very, very impressed with the guy. And so I want to do other conversations with him in the future. I think it would be really enjoyable. And I've got a project underway where I'm rereading all of Plato's dialogues this year and Xenophon's Socratic writings too. So there are 35 dialogues, there are the letters, and there are 4 pieces by Xenophon, and I'm working through them all. So I've got Plato on the brain. So he says, keep up the good work, Greg and David. Question, are the regime's anti-white policies creating a growing class of hyper-competent white men with chips on their shoulders? If so, is this a tactical mistake? The short answer is yes and yes. They have created a whole bunch of highly competent white men with chips on their shoulders who have been disenfranchised. And of course, this started in academia. It was the worst place. Academia is where the worst trends are advancing. And it has spread to the rest of society, unfortunately. I was in academia, and when I got my PhD, things were so bad with political correctness, I basically just gave up hope of having an academic career. And what I did have was very brief. And I was so glad to get out of it. But yeah, what that allowed me to do is become a full-time thorn in the side of the system. And I'd like to be a bigger and bigger pain. And as my reach grows, I will be a bigger and bigger pain. Now, if I had simply gotten the academic job of my dreams, I would be toiling away in academia. I'd be biting my tongue all the time rather than speaking out about the idiocy and the insanity around me. And the things I would write would be going into academic journals that might be read 5 times. And I would have absolutely no impact on the world. And that would have been a better deal for the system. The system would have been happier if it had co-opted me. But these people don't think that way. There's no wise elders plotting this out. What's going on is that we simply have large numbers of well-placed people in the grip of hateful and fanatical ideologies competing with one another to see who can push it further with no breaks and no sense, wait, hold off, maybe we should slow this down or be a little more clever about it. And this is going to be their undoing. And I've met quite a number of really impressive people along the way. There are quite a number of people who write for Countercurrents who have PhDs in philosophy, for instance, just like myself. And David, you did the internal movement poll. Do you recall what percentage of the people who answered that poll for Countercurrents had PhDs, medical degrees, or law degrees? I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it was pretty significant.
I can't either, but I can look that up right now if you like. So,
yeah.
Yeah. In the meantime, I'll just say that I'm kind of one of those people, and there are a lot of us. We're growing. It's kind of like the Fight Club saying where we figured out we're not going to be rock stars and we're really, really upset about it. Like, we're not going to be lawyers. You know, these people, their law school is full of women and brown people now. And it's weird. You're dispossessing these people, and we're the type of people who won the Cold War for them. And now, even if I was given a job with a 3-letter agency and could bring myself to work with them, I'd do what's called quiet quitting. I would not go the extra mile. I would do the bare minimum to get money, and that'd be it. I would not take pride in my work. And this is the issue, too, with the government and regime. Even when they, aside from the problem of having angry white men who are highly competent in intelligence, the ones they do have aren't going to be making the wheels of civilization turn. They're just going to be there for a paycheck and abuse it. I hope they abuse it like a welfare system, because that's what it is. But I have this opened up. Let me see. So here, so master's degree, 19.3%. PhD, 6.7%. Law school, those are my people, let's go, 6.1%. And hate to say this, but a lot of them had slightly higher LSAT scores than me. Dental school, 1%. Yeah, so that's a lot. So if we add master's and law school, that's like 25. So that's about 30% right there. Maybe a little bit more than 30% have an advanced degree of some type.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really great. And that indicates the kind of people we're reaching. And that's the kind of audience that I wanted to reach. I want to reach people who are highly intelligent. I was aiming at people with an IQ of 120 or above. It turns out that the average IQ of the people who answer that test is 130, which is what I was aiming for. So that's the lower end of the extremely gifted range. Now, there are hundreds of thousands, millions of white people who are very, very intelligent and gifted. And intelligent people have a disproportionate influence on the future. And therefore, that's, I think, a wise strategy to pursue. We have to figure out how to mobilize larger and larger numbers of people political realm, there's no question about that. But if we get to the point where, say, 5% of the population fervently believes in the stuff that we believe, and another 5 to 10% of the population is, well, they're okay with it, right? They don't have intense beliefs maybe, but they certainly would be rooting for us. And another chunk of the population would be neutral. They wouldn't kill or die to stop us. Well, at a certain point, we're going to start mobilizing larger and larger numbers of people in the political realm to change things. That's just how these things work. And again, it would be nice if the movement had invested the capital necessary for us to have answers to this already. But by creating Homeland Institute, I've taken the steps necessary to do this. And I've gotten David working for Homeland, who has the skills. And the next thing is just to basically have the money and infrastructure to do larger scale polling broken down by congressional districts and states to try and get a more precise mapping of the American mind, to know where our people are and to better understand how to reach them. One thing that we discovered with this internal movement poll is that it was basically, we asked the question, how quickly or how long did it take for you to come to agree with white nationalist ideas after your first exposure? 1/3 of the people said it was immediate. 1/3 said it took months, and 1/3 said it took years. I was in the years category, actually. Maybe that doesn't speak well of me. What David is working on right now is creating profiles of those three categories. Can we find identifiable profiles of the people who, when exposed to RD ideas, immediately are converted? Because if we can pinpoint the profile of people like that, that allows us to take our scarce propaganda dollars and focus with laser-like precision on the easiest people first, the easiest people to convert. And that's something that a highly intelligent movement that's strapped for cash needs to know. And this is the kind of work that David is doing. And he's not doing that particular work through Homeland Institute. He's doing that for Countercurrents directly. But it's the same skill set, the same technology. So yeah, we are capturing highly intelligent, highly competent white people with chips on their shoulders. Basically, the chip on their shoulder is that they have been dispossessed or marginalized. They've been treated unjustly by the current system. And a lot of them would like payback. A lot of them would like to overturn this order and put something better in its place. And I completely agree with that. I believe in righteous indignation. We do have righteousness on our side. So let's see if there's some more questions here. Okay, White American writes in with $10. Thanks for the amazing work of all the writers at Countercurrents. Thank you very much, Dr. Johnson. Really appreciate that. Thank you. Unknown Californian writes in with $3, sending words of appreciation to you. Greg, thank you for doing everything you do. Well, thank you. Let's check with Odyssey. Folks, if you want to send Odyssey tips, you certainly can. You can also send diamonds, lemons, ninjets, ninjaginis, all those tokens over at DLive, and we will cash those in at the end of the year and apply them to our fundraiser. And in the past, when there were more people on DLive, that was thousands of dollars a year. The DLive audience has dwindled, but it still makes a difference. So send those tokens our way. Archie writes in with another $3 on Odyssey. In Canada, around 2008, my boss asked me if I belonged to a visible minority. I should have said that I'm a Jew. He explained to me that if he can prove to the government of Canada that at least 10% of the employees in the business are visible minorities, then the government will give the business a tax break. Yeah, this is how they basically force white people out of jobs and less qualified non-white people into jobs. They give incentives to businesses to do that. And yes, I think that since the whole thing is a anti-white racket, that if white people want to just lie and say, I'm an American Indian, prove that I'm wrong, they should do that. Go ahead. Say you're Jewish, whatever. just get ahead in this system. Do not let these people dispossess you. Which goes to another issue of the march through the institutions. There are a lot of people who say, just drop out of society. There are institutions that white people should drop out of. They should not be in the U.S. military. Why? Well, because we don't want the military to be effective, basically. But we should not drop out of the professions. We should not drop out of college and things like that, even though it's stacked against us. I do think that if you can go through college and not incur ungodly amounts of debt, and actually can get an education, and you might have to do a lot of self-educating, then you should do it. And you should hold your nose and you should do it, because we need people with credentials and actual skills. We don't want to cede entire regions of the culture to our enemies. Now, I do believe that we should not enlist. I think we should withhold that, because that is one way that we can punish the system. The system is anti-white. It shits on white men, yet it depends on white men fighting and dying for it. We should say no, absolutely not. But we should definitely still pursue degrees and credentials and careers. We should not drop out. If we work for enemy institutions, we should gum up the works. But that's part of the long march through the institutions. You've got to get into the enemy institution first. So, David, what are your thoughts?
Right.
More about rogue elites.
People should not be ruining their life and making bad decisions because somebody gave them advice on the internet. And that includes me to some extent too. But yes, less people should be going to college. But please do not destroy your opportunities because somebody told you that on Twitter who doesn't even know you or your talents or your situation. And there is ways around that, like you said, like, look, I went to community college for 2 years and there's no shame in that. It was very cost effective. It's easier to work. You can probably live at home. Commuting will be easier. You save money that way. In fact, the system likes that because these four-year colleges are so impacted. You're taking pressure off of them by going to community college. And you want the final degree you get doesn't say like, was not a real college student. It's the same deal. So it's cheaper way to do the same thing. And two, by going to college, this is a great way to politically network with other people. There are going to be other white people there who are not happy, and you're going to be outnumbered. But guess what? That creates kind of like you're like the new Jews or Arminians. You're a hated minority. That makes it easier to network, ironically, and sniff each other out. Like, just go to Turning Point USA, College Republicans, sniff around and see if you can find fellow travelers and pick it up. Sniff them out. Yes, these are, controlled opposition organizations usually, but not always. And that's where like-minded people like you will be at. And for the military, it's along with helping the regime, I kind of maybe walk back my former articles. I understand that there are some white people who have no other option because they make college unaffordable for a white person without a trust fund, without going to the military. But if you do join, try not to join because, yes, you're helping the system. You can also die in World War III. Now, Biden could sleepwalk in a global conflict. I'll write a whole article about that later probably. But a global conflict which will have high casualties. It's not like before where we get to choose time and manner of the conflict. It will come to us. Just don't do it. If your college education isn't worth it, the GI Bill, if you're dead. And two, before war was a little bit more controlled, you could decide if you were going to be a frontline infantryman or not. Nowadays, you don't really know what's going to happen because who says some hypersonic missile won't hit your base or whatever, or a drone, or there'll be, Chinese militia, Chinese saboteurs attacking bases. You don't know that. This is a whole different. The war is not the same as the global war on terror, where it's basically slapping goat herders around with expensive missiles. There is parity now. America's not the, people can touch and hurt America. We could lose an aircraft carrier. So even if you're like the cook or the personnel specialist, you might not be as safe as you think you were. And if you do join, you better go rogue, which is retired on active duty from day one. And don't get yourself in trouble, but don't be a star player either. Do the bare minimum. Don't just escape notice. Get out, get the GI Bill, and say bye, Felicia.
Yeah. I think that that's all valid. The rules of reality apply. Has sent a $25 gift. Thank you very much. Thiel Musk and others don't want college grads or empty PhDs. Use all avenues, autodidacts who do and show proof can pursue avenues through these rogue elites. College, yes. Self-taught, just do it, yes. Another pissed off white man with posterity who longs for the American Appian way. Jar Jar 2024. Well, that's great. I appreciate that. Yeah. Here's the thing. Whatever path you take, don't give up on ambitions because it's going to be hard. The fact that it is hard is actually something that's sort of character building. Now, you shouldn't stupidly do things like get into ungodly amounts of unpayable debt unless you just simply plan not to pay it back. You can flee the country, whatever.
I hate to interrupt, but
yeah,
that's another problem with this green card thing is that these students could come here. I know I'm going off topic. These students can come here, pay for that degree, and then possibly leave. They might try to make it here on the green card for a while, but if it doesn't work, they'll just leave, and collecting their debt will be, for all intents and purposes, impractical and impossible.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just zero risks for that. And it's a grand example of moral hazard. But yeah, don't give up on your ambitions just because the system is going to make it hard. You know, this is our country. This is our planet. The future belongs to white people. We're the only people who are going to carry civilization forward. Let's be honest. The Asians can copy us all they want until we cease to exist, and then they're just going to stagnate, sadly. We're the ones who carry it all forward. We're the heirs of this, and we should comport ourselves in that way. We should have such huge ambitions that basically it cracks the system that thwarts us. Years ago, I read an interview with Alistair MacIntyre, who's I think he's still alive in his 90s. He's a Scottish-born political philosopher and historian of ideas. And he said that education should make people as unfit as possible for living in the modern world. Why did he say that? Well, because he wants them to overthrow the modern world. And I feel the same way. I want people to overthrow this particular system. And the way to overthrow this particular system is to become too big for it to contain, too ambitious for it to contain. You know, we've had this question a couple of times. The person who finally turns it all around, the person who saves the white race and saves the planet, that person will, to future generations, be almost a god. That person will have eternal glory. That person will be a legend. Why are there not more people who want to take up that task, right? Why are there not more people who want to risk that? It sounds very grandiose, but well, you know, we have to be a little bit grandiose because we literally have to save the world from evil here, folks. And we're actually doing it in the real world. It's not a game. It's not an online game, although a lot of it's played online, right? But we're actually saving the world from evil. And that's a big task. So we need big people with big ambitions and big visions to go along with that. And don't let the system thwart that. Don't let the little disappointments thwart that. Don't let the petty meanness that's directed at white people today, especially young white people, thwart that. And this is something that we really have to think about very strongly. I'm glad I'm as old as I am, because when I grew up, it was fairly normal. There was stuff that I was getting in grade school that I look back at that was propagandistic, you know, Earth Day and stuff like that. We planted a tree on Earth Day when I was in second grade, I remember. But, you know, that's not a bad thing to do, plant a tree. So anyway, I was spared the systematic psychological abuse that Zoomers and younger people, even millennials, were going through when they were going through school and immersed in popular culture. It is systematic, it's all-encompassing, and it's deeply demoralizing to white people. And a lot of young white people have never had a kind word spoken to them. They've never been encouraged. They've never been encouraged to be ambitious. They've just been, you know, going around trying to keep their heads down so they won't be attacked and abused. And it's criminal because we're the greatest race on the planet. We've accomplished more than any other race. We are the legitimate heirs of civilization. We're the only people who can keep it moving forward. And we have to be bigger than the system, so it basically is burst asunder by our ambitions. And we can't let people say, oh, the game is rigged, boys, you know, just give up. We can't do that. We have to fight that. So I'm against all the go off the grid type people. If you're going to go off the grid, you better be doing it to gather your strength so you can come back and make a big difference. So that's the only justification for that kind of attitude. But yeah, whether you do it through college or being an autodidact, a genius tinkering in your garage, don't let them to beat your ambitions out of you. Don't let them beat your white ingenuity and vision out of you, because we need that if we're going to survive and overthrow this horrible system.
Right. I just want to piggyback off that. All of our myths, our stories, our books, our video games, they were probably training you for this, to literally save the world from evil. So it's time to harden up and play Dungeons and Dragons in real life. And remember, Frodo didn't go cry in the Shire. He went out and confronted the problem.
So, folks, I think this has been a good discussion. David, thank you very much. Oh, one thing I want to talk about at the very end. I think that the next poll that Homeland should do is on this green card scheme and related things. I would like to know how this is playing in Peoria with white registered voters. Is this going to help Trump or hurt him? He probably just shot his mouth off without actually knowing what the effects would be. Is there any way that you can test this?
Oh, absolutely. I could probably ask a slew of questions, including questions that normally wouldn't be asked, like, are you concerned about fraud? Are you concerned about them competing with your children for spots in college? Are you worried about ethnic nepotism and affirmative action? Do you think it's fair that they get a green card? And other matters, or do you think this bodes ill for other policies? Or do you think this, there's a whole bunch of questions I can ask and then show that this is a horrible policy and that it is not well supported by the voters.
Yeah, I would really love to see that. I'd like to know if this dud of a policy is going to be something that Republican voters will accept or push back on. And I'd like to get a measurement of psychological intensity too. I think that's very important. But anyway, that's something for future discussion. David, why don't you tell the folks out there how they can follow your work?
Yes, so you can follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter. It's at David Zutty, ZSUTTY. It's pretty unique, so it's easy to find if you can spell it. Also at Homeland, INST. And you can also follow the Homeland Institute at https://homelandinstitute.org. And I'm also on Telegram, David Zutty, and the Homeland Institute.
Excellent. And I think we have just gotten 14 lemons from Slog. So thank you very much, Slog. I really appreciate it. 14 lemons. We're celebrating. We just celebrated last week our 14th birthday, our 14th anniversary of coming online. So it's appropriate. I appreciate that. Next week, we will be back. Morgoth will be here. I hope some of our other UK contingent will be here. We're going to talk about zero seats and maybe memeing that into reality. I think that would be tremendously exciting. Also, I'm going to do an interview, not during the live stream, but during the regular week sometime, if we can make it work, with Academic Agent, because he's got a lot of thoughts on zero seats and clearing them out too. And I'd like to get his take on this. So we're definitely going to be going into the UK election, paying a lot of attention to zero seats. And in a couple of weeks, we'll revisit this, I hope with good news, and start reflecting on how we can, you know, make use of that if indeed the Tories are gutted. We can make use of that in other white countries. So I think this is a very exciting time to be alive. So tune in next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio. And in the meantime, keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you so much for your donations, for your listenership. Thank you to our moderators, and we will be back.